Welcome to Top 5, a show where we count things down from number 5 all the way to number 1. And this week, we're going to have to follow the clues. We're going to have to follow the dame walking down the street to find out what our number 1 movies are this week. Top 5 mystery movies. And I got to say, Rodrigo, this is a rather difficult category. And I think for most people, when you listen to my top 5, it'll be like, yeah, Steven's talked about those movies before. But, you know, if you're, I've been doing this kind of weird search for like, hey, let's find some other mystery movies besides the 5 that I always watch again and again. And sure. I came up with ones that, what is it called? Broken Hearts or something that I was talking about a couple of weeks ago on the Major Spoilers podcast. And it's like, technically it's listed as a mystery, but it's more of a farcical romp.
Sure.
And it's like, well, I really wouldn't consider that a mystery, but okay. And if you go to Rotten Tomatoes, they list Citizen Kane as a mystery. And it's like, right. Is it?
Yeah.
Is it really?
And everything that I found, they're like, hey, great mystery movie, Get Out. And I'm like, I love Get Out. I don't feel like it's a mystery at all.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts, Rodrigo?
I think that a mystery movie is something where like the core of the movie is like answering some sort of question. You know, like who, like that's why Citizen Kane fits, right? It's like, it's a movie about like a guy tracking down all of this information about Kane.
Right.
So it's like, I haven't seen Gone Girl, but presumably it's like, where is Gone Girl, right?
Yeah, but I mean, technically it would be kind of a mystery, but it's also more of a thriller because, and sure. here's probably part of the reason why my number 5 is so low on the list, because most of the movie in both Gone Girl and in my number 5 Knives Out is the person who thinks that they've committed the crime. We're following that person as she attempts to cover up the supposed crime that she has committed in Knives Out. Of course, then we have Harlan Trombley, played by Daniel Craig, just, you know, following the clues, trying to figure things out. But he knows from the very first moment, you know, who, you know, that our main heroine is somehow involved. And it's only when you finally figure out who done it and why that you're like, ah, okay. With Gone Girl, it's like, you know what happened to the girl and you're hoping that she can get out alive. Also, Get Out tends to be, you said, Matthew, one of those mystery movies. So my number 5, Knives Out, and it's a very good movie. I really enjoy it a lot.
It's the best Foghorn Leghorn picture in history, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, there you go. And, you know, I cannot wait to see the next two movies, but my number 5 is Knives Out. But I don't know, Rodrigo, what you have for your number 5, if it falls into the Gone Girl category or not, or how many Ben Affleck actors you have on your list.
How many Ben Afflecks does
yes,
this
how many
have?
Ben Afflecks does
I
this
believe
movie
it has none, but because I think at this point Affleck was really on top of things and would have commanded kind of a big check. But my number 5 is Memento.
Yeah.
And it's my number 5 because I think the first time you watch Memento, it does feel like a mystery. Mainly what's going on, you know, what's the deal, what's happening. But once you've watched it all the way through and you start, you know, especially if you go back and watch it again and you start putting things in chronological order, it's like, actually, this is a very straightforward movie and there kind of isn't a mystery here. But it's a movie that completely relies on its structure, right?
Right.
Because it's unreliable and because it shows you things out of order, it creates a mystery where there wouldn't necessarily be one. Or where the question that it poses would be answered immediately within the first like 20 minutes of the movie. But you know, still a fun movie.
Yeah.
And you know, one of those movies that really created this symptom that in the 90s and early 2000s every movie had to have a twist.
Yeah.
Right.
And it also launched Christopher Nolan's career. It made him a big name.
Yeah.
And so we can thank it. Now we can tie Memento directly to Tenet, but you're going to have to look at my Polaroids and we're going to have to look at the tattoos on my chest to really figure out what the heck Tenet means. Matthew, what do you have for number 5?
Eat at Joe's. What does that even mean? My number 5 is actually an example of my existential angst and dread about this particular category, because I don't set out to upset or irritate Steven when he moderates top five.
Let me guess. Did you put Mystery Men as your number five because it has the word mystery in the title?
That's funny. I should have done that. No. But this is interesting because I spoke before the show, but you have a very specific love of time travel movies. Uh-huh. So specific that you will take movies that have time travel elements and you will say, this is not a time travel movie. And one of the movies that you have said is not a time travel movie is my number five, even though
This is mystery movies, not time travel movies.
Stay with me. My number five mystery movie is technically a slasher movie, technically a comedy, but there is a central mystery to it. And the mystery is who is killing our protagonist over and over and over. And that movie is Happy Death Day, which is a movie that I adore. It is just this weird, it feels like a weird little indie film, even though it's a Blumhouse horror movie. And the central premise of it all is a girl named Tree, short for Teresa, wakes up one day. It's her birthday and she dies. And then she wakes up the same day, remembering what just happened, goes through her whole day and she dies. And she starts cycling through a series of deaths, trying to unravel who it is that's going to kill her, in the hopes that if she figures out who is killing her, that she'll live through to tomorrow. And it's actually a pretty, you know, it's a cool premise. It's one of those elevator pitch things where
Groundhog Day, but with slasher flick
mentality. But Friday the 13th.
Yeah. Yeah. The reason why I don't call it a time travel movie is because Groundhog Day isn't a time travel movie. There's not a device. And then everyone's pointing out, but there is a device, Steven. You find out that the cupcake is a time travel device in the second movie. And it's like, no. If you have to do backflips and wave your hand and tell people pay no attention to the man behind the curtain to explain how a cupcake is your time travel device, is not a time travel movie. Sorry. I'll count it as a mystery movie because you are trying to figure out, you know, who done it. But it's definitely
really,
not a time
it's
travel.
Really a solidly constructed film. And I feel like the thing that really sells it is the main actress, Jessica Roth, who is, you know, she goes through this transformation from, she really feels like one of the plastics from Mean Girls at the end or at the beginning of the film. And by the end, she's turned into a really relatable, cool protagonist that you're like, yeah, I like her. I'm with her. And of course, you know, it's the second movie where she jumps out of an airplane onto her ex-boyfriend and her evil best friend who are kissing each other. And I love that moment. I actually have it as a GIF on my phone and I use it all the time. But if you ever get a chance to watch Happy Death Day, be aware, first of all, it's not really a slasher movie and it's not really a time travel movie. It's not really a lot of things, but I feel like it is solidly a mystery.
Well, yeah, and Groundhog Day is not a time travel movie either. But as you described it, Matthew, this movie is, what if Groundhog Day meets, you know, a slasher flick?
What if Groundhog Day on Friday the 13th is what it is?
Yeah. All right, we have looped back around to our number fours. And one thing that I noticed, well, at least for three of my next four movies, one of the big hooks that you find in these is that two unrelated cases suddenly become related. And that is how the hero figures out the crime that has been done. In my number four, this is one that I think passed a lot of people by. I don't think it has super great reviews, but I really like the way that Shane Black crafts this story of Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe as a pair of, well, one of them is a detective. Ryan Gosling is the detective. Russell Crowe is more of an enforcer guy. And they somehow get involved in this crazy missing girl murder, also turns into a murdered porn star, which also turns into a conspiracy by the auto industry to cover up the catalytic converter and all the pollution that's going on in the Los Angeles area in the 1970s. It's also a comedy, as many Shane Black movies tend to be. You know, you look at Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and you look at, didn't he do one of the...
He did Iron Man 3, I think.
Yeah, Iron Man 3. I think he also did, I want to say he did one of the Lethal Weapon movies, maybe Lethal Weapon 3, I want to say. But they all kind of have these comedic elements on top of, you know, an action kind of thriller kind of thing. But this one, it's really well done, especially the girl who plays Ryan Gosling's daughter is fantastic in this. And you just see kind of two bumbling idiots, you know, figure out the whodunit, figure out, you know, what the auto industry is doing and why they had to kill this person. And then they solve the crime and save the girls in the end. So the nice guys, it's worth checking out. It's, it didn't receive a lot of high reviews because I think that a lot of people really didn't appreciate what Shane Black was doing, which was basically Kiss Kiss Bang Bang again. But it's still a fun movie. And so The Nice Guys is my number four mystery movie.
Now, is Russell Crowe playing the son of Sergeant White from L.A. Confidential, where he also played a weird enforcer guy in a police suit?
No, and L.A. Confidential, I was going to have on my list, but it was just like, there are so many others that I like a lot more. But no, yeah. And no to both of your questions. Rodrigo, Bummer. What do you have for number four?
My number four is, I think there are certain names that immediately get you thinking about mysteries, right? You hear like the character's name, you're like, this must be a mystery. Something like Poirot or something like Miss Marple. Mm-hmm. So of course, my number four is Detective Pikachu.
Yep. It's a straight up mystery movie.
Detective Pikachu is a very straightforward mystery movie. You have to find out what happened to Justice Smith's dad. You have to find out why we have this talking Pikachu, and of course, it all gets embroiled into a dastardly conspiracy to, let me check, turn everybody into Pokemon. So right. You can't, spoiler alert, it has the bad guy turns out to be Gorilla Grodd, I guess. Detective Pikachu is very cute and a very straightforward detective movie, and mm-hmm. It takes place in the world of Pokemon. So if you like Pokemon, at least you're going to have something to look at constantly, because there's constantly Pokemon in the frame.
Yeah, everywhere.
Right? So,
no, and it's a surprisingly good movie, too, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people, I think, just dismissed it, and it turns out to be a really fun movie.
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah. Matthew, what do you have for your number four?
My number four is a straight up mystery. Top to bottom, it is a mystery. And it has at its center one of the actors that you associate with great acting in a period from about 1977 to about 1982. It starts with our main character, who is an investigative reporter, being paid to murder a man who claims that he has a disease, but doesn't. And that is when Irwin M. Fletcher starts looking into the case of Boyd Aviation. My number four, Fletch, starring that wonderful, mysterious actor, Chevy Chase, from, I think, 1985 or so. It would have been
somewhere
right
around
after.
There.
Yeah, it would have been right after the peak.
It was
of
after
Chevy's
Ghostbusters, and it was after Spies Like Us.
Yeah, but it's a really good movie, and it has the things that I love in a movie. In that, one, it's very quotable.
Mm-hmm.
Two, when you have an over the top actor like, you know, Chevy Chase, or likewise John Belushi, or if you get, you know, somebody who really does do that larger than life scenery chewing thing like Charlotte Ray, you got to let them go. And Fletch is a movie that just lets Chevy go nuts. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But all of it really kind of comes together, because when he falls apart, it feels like it's because Irwin M. Fletcher is a yutz. And in universe, when, you know, Chevy's shtick is stupid, it's because Irwin M. Fletcher is kind of stupid, but he pulls it all together. He works it all out. You know, it has similar elements in a lot of ways to The Big Lebowski, where, you know, he's not necessarily the best detective in the world, but things come together for him. And there's a human aspect and a humorous aspect to it. And of course, it's got a young George Wendt in it, which I think is hilarious.
Yeah.
George Wendt playing a drug dealer on the beach, no less. Yeah. But if you get a chance to watch it, just watch it for the scene where where the walking tall guy pulls a gun on Chevy Chase, and Chevy Chase is like, you know what? Yeah, you're right. I'm just going to kill this story. Don't shoot me in the face. Everything you say is fine. Just let me go. And it's such a wonderful kind of a devolution of what I expect from a mystery film. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to fight this to the end. Oh, wait, there's a gun. Nope, sorry, bye.
Yeah,
I love that moment. And if you've never seen Fletch, I do recommend it, even if you're allergic to Chevy, because it's a good flick.
Yeah, there are some moments. There's a blackface moment in the movie that doesn't hold up after all these years. Yeah. Although you can see why they put it in there, but at this, you know, because it's a fantasy element, but it's also right. Chevy Chase in blackface, which will probably creepy. Put a bunch of people off. And there's also a couple of moments of, I enjoy the movie. What I would suggest, Matthew, if you haven't, I would suggest reading the Fletch novels. There's a whole series of these. I have made my way through about 10 of the 20 Fletch books, and they're all really good. And it is clear that you can see, if you read the first Fletch book, you can see kind of where they lifted things and plop them into the movie and where the adaptation is. But at the same time, I think in this, you see somebody who is really a smart person, who's really a good investigative reporter, who just doesn't care. That's his whole thing, is he just doesn't care. Whereas in the movie, it makes him come off as he's kind of an idiot, but it's just like, no, he's really intelligent. He's really smart. He knows how to be a really great investigative journalist. He just doesn't care about the system at all. And considering that the books were written in the 70s and the movie didn't come out until the 80s, there's that disconnect between the man, you know, fighting against the man and those kind of things. But Fletch is a really, really good movie.
Yep.
All right. My number three is Inherent Vice. It is one that I've talked about before. It is a very different kind of detective movie in that Joaquin Phoenix plays Doc Sportello, who one night an ex-girlfriend shows up and says, "Hey, this guy, this rich guy that I've been sleeping with has kind of disappeared, and I think they're after me." And she disappears, and so Sportello is trying to find out what happened to her, but in the process, he uncovers this giant conspiracy that's going on. And it's really a good movie that's well done, and it's done in the haze of the late 60s, early 70s drug craze in Los Angeles, or maybe it's San Francisco. No, it's Los Angeles. And it's really good. And once you watch it, I think you have to watch it a couple times before you start to see a lot of things play out. At one point, there's a character that I realized, oh, wait, this character is all inside Sportello's mind. And then that brings in the question of, well, how much of this story is unreliable? Because we know that the narrator is unreliable. And this moment that he has late in the film, you have to question, did those things actually happen? So this is a Paul Thomas Anderson movie. It came out in 2014. It is one that I've talked before that I have to be very careful about, because if I'm scrolling through the list of movies on my Apple device and I see Inherent Vice and I'm just kind of bored, I'll probably end up watching this movie just because it's like, oh, you know, this is such a funny movie. It's got Martin Short is as a drug addicted orthodontist. And he just steals the show when he is in it. Of course, every character steals the show when they're in it, including Josh Brolin, who plays a hardcore detective for the Los Angeles Police Department, who has wishes and ambitions to also be an actor and get a lot of that Hollywood money in his pocket, as well as trying to serve the law. So it's really interesting. It kind of plays a little bit on the hippie culture and, you know, the dirty hippie kind of meme that goes on, because Sportello is a dirty hippie that, you know, does a lot of drugs. It's a good movie. The mystery is there. And as it starts to play out and as it starts to become uncovered, it's worth watching again and again and again. Unlike, as you said earlier, Rodrigo, with Memento, once you know the hook and you see what happens, then you kind of doesn't make the rest of the movie fun. But I think in Inherent Vice, you watch it once and you're like, okay, here are the things. Let me watch it again to start pulling out these little pieces that are here and there. And pretty soon the story becomes super complex and super deep. I'm about ready to start the book. This is the book that the film is based on, from Thomas Pynchon. And I started it a long time ago, but I just never got into it. So I'm going to pick it back up and try it again, knowing what I know from the movie and knowing what I know about Pynchon. And see if I enjoy that a lot more. But Inherent Vice is a really good movie, and it lands at my number three. Rodrigo, what do you have for number three?
My number three is a movie that it came out in 2018, and I'm very surprised that, like, no one cared. I don't know that it did very well. I caught it once on cable and I was like, what is this movie? I'd literally never heard of it. Kind of going off of both an unreliable narrator, as Steven says, and Happy Death Day kind of slasher mystery, like Matthew put up, I would submit You Might Be the Killer.
Mm.
2018 has Allison Hannigan and the protagonist Fran Kranz. I don't know what else he's been on. But the idea is that there's a slasher that's killing, some teenage, like the camp counselors are there, like before the camp opens, having fun and, you know, getting frisky with each other. And then a slasher shows up and starts killing them. The protagonist, Sam, calls up his friend who is a slasher movie, super duper fangirl, right? And that's Allison Hannigan. And so they start talking, and then as it progresses, it kind of seems more and more like actually the killer is Sam. It's interesting. It's a funny movie. It's a little bit of a scary movie, but it's interesting because the mystery then becomes, how does he not know that, right? First off, who's the killer? Then it's like, oh, it's Sam. Well, how does he not realize that he's the killer? And so the movie kind of lays out a new mystery every time it solves one until you get to the very end. I found it very enjoyable. Again, I'm surprised that, like, I've never heard anybody talk about this movie, even to make fun of it or to say that it's bad. It just completely under the radar as far as I'm concerned. It's my number three. You Might Be the Killer.
All right. Very good. I have not heard of that movie.
Yeah.
And it is kind of a surprising that, you know, it's got some named actors in there, but mm-hmm. It just seemed to have gone nowhere. Interesting. Matthew, what are we on? Three. What is your number three?
My number three is something that you and I have talked about actually in the past, and you have immediately, you've said it's terrible and bad and you hate it and it's awful. But for me, I feel like the classical moments of it really work. I mean, bringing in unexpected references, essentially what it breaks down to is sort of a hippy-dippy remake of The Phantom of the Opera, told through a lens of country music and betrayal and stabbing and talking dogs. And of course, I'm talking about the new Scooby-Doo movies, season 1, episode 12, The Phantom of the Country Music Hall. This is one of my favorite childhood movies. It's actually, and it is a movie because it clearly says in the title, the new Scooby-Doo movies. But The Phantom of the Country Music Hall features one of my heroes, one of my idols, one of the people who I look up to in the world, and that's the Alabama madman, Jerry Reed. And Jerry Reed, of course, is supposed to be singing at a country music hall, but when Mystery Inc. arrives, they find that Jerry is missing. They can't find him. They can only hear him singing through the fence, and they have to figure out who's trying to keep Jerry Reed from singing. And it's remarkably complex, you know, for a Hanna-Barbera cartoon for 1972, but it also features Jerry Reed in it. And Jerry Reed, you know, pre-Smokey and the Bandit, but post-Amos Moses, is one of those characters who, no matter what he's saying or doing, it's entertaining. I mean, Jerry Reed could literally read you the menu from an IHOP, but it'd probably more likely be a Waffle House, and it would be entertaining. And so when you figure out what's going on and when it all comes together and when Jerry and Scooby-Doo team up to bring down the evil villain with, you know, probably a trap involving some ropes and some stuff that they had in the mystery machine.
And a giant sandwich.
It's satisfying. Yeah. It's satisfying. A xylophone at play. It comes into play as well.
It's also really satisfying when they try to rip off Jerry Reed's face to reveal the killer underneath. And then they realize, holy crap. And they realize, holy crap, we just ripped off Jerry Reed's face. It's a real twist that nobody sees coming.
It's from the same show where we saw them team up with Don Knotts and the Three Stooges and the Addams Family and Batman and Sandy Duncan, because Batman and Sandy Duncan.
Oh, and don't forget Phyllis Diller. And then years later, Weird Al Yankovic.
There was also a Mama Cass episode in there.
Yes, I remember that one too.
72, 73.
You said the Addams Family already?
Yep.
Davy Jones.
Yeah. Davies is not the best, but Jerry Reed nails it. And he sings a song that 50 years later will still wedge in my brain if I so much as mention it. So I cannot say the name of the song, but be aware that the title of the song is also the entire chorus of the song. And it will stick in your brain. Literally, I had this in my head from about 1980 to about 1985. And it's really why I didn't get into the really good schools. So that's why my number three, the new Scooby-Doo movies, because it has movie in the title, : Phantom of the Country Music Hall.
All right, there you go. My number two, this might come as a surprise. This is the twist that no one expects in the mystery. This is the one where you're like, aha, the killer has been revealed and it is Matthew. And they're like, no, sorry, it's not Matthew. And everyone's like, what? But all the clues point to Matthew. And people are like, nope, sorry, we're going to go in a whole other direction, which is why many of you may be surprised when I say my number two mystery movie is Chinatown. Because I love Chinatown. I love me some J.J. Gittes. I love Jack Nicholson as he plays one of the Jakes that is trying to solve the mystery of what happened to Mr. Mole Ray. And then we do a deep dive into the whole affair with Faye Dunaway, Mrs. Mole Ray, and her father, played by John Huston. And I mean, there's this shocking moment that works perfectly in the 1970s as a shocking moment. But today seems to be kind of like, yeah, there's like a Pornhub category for that. It's not really that shocking. But Chinatown is full of twists. It is full of, again, it's a kind of a complex mystery that some people can go, oh, yes, I can follow all the plot points every step of the way. And that's great. But I really think that in order to really understand what's going on in Chinatown, you kind of have to watch it multiple times to find out all the nuance. I would highly recommend, and again, you shouldn't have to do a lot of work to enjoy a movie, and you can watch this and just enjoy the movie. It's got, what's his name, from Big Trouble in Little China in it, so you know it's good. Victor Wong.
Kurt Russell.
No, not is it Victor Wong? No. Who am I thinking of? Anyway.
Who did he play?
He played the butler at the for the Mrs. Mulray.
Who did he play in Big Trouble in Little China?
He played the bad guy.
That's James Hong.
Oh, James Hong. Yeah. Victor Wong is awesome. The magician guy. But the thing about Chinatown is I think the movie becomes more enjoyable the more research you do. So if you go into the water rights issues of what was going on in Los Angeles and how, even though these are fictitious characters in the movie, how the real life people kind of duped northern parts of Los Angeles and parts of Orange County out of their water rights, and then stole it to make Los Angeles the city it is. Then suddenly Chinatown has even deeper meanings and even deeper depths to it than just the surface. Now the drawback to Chinatown, just like we were talking about Chevy Chase doing blackface, this is a Roman Polanski movie. And so for those of you who have a deep hate and desire of Roman Polanski, and look, I'm not being a Roman Polanski apologist. I don't care for Roman Polanski myself, but this is a really, really good film. And if you go in and look at the making of Chinatown and everything that Robert Towne and Polanski and who was the producer on this, I'm thinking of it off the top of my head. Bob Evans. And you look at everything that went into the making of that, you start to get a little bit more respect for that. And then also you just have an appreciation of the film. But I understand that Roman Polanski is one of those people that will set people off. And so I totally understand if you're like, I will never watch Chinatown because of Roman Polanski. I totally understand that completely. So my number two is Chinatown, which is that big twist in the mystery, which is why everyone's like, oh my gosh, now I don't know who the number one mystery movie is.
Who's it going to be?
Yeah, but Matthew, I think we need to get to Rodrigo, we need to get to your number two.
Yeah.
My number two is, I mentioned that in the early 2000s, every movie had to have a twist, and that's because of this movie. My number two is The Sixth Sense, and I'm going to try and convince you guys that it is a mystery.
It is a mystery.
And it's a mystery. It's when you look at The Sixth Sense as a mystery, All of the tropes are there. All of the tricks are there. You know, cutting away from things, not letting you see an entire scene the way that it plays out, and so on. But you don't realize that you have been watching a mystery until the end. You don't know what the question of the sixth sense is until the end. And then it recontextualizes everything, as, you know, a lot of mysteries do when you figure out, oh, it was this person. Well, how did they do it? And then they start telling you, remember that scene that you only saw half of? Well, the other half was this, you know, and the sixth sense kind of does that to you. And it's very surprising the first time around because you don't realize that you're watching a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it puts you in that mindset, it moves like a mystery thriller, even though only perfectly mundane things ever happen, right? Except for the spooky parts. But, you know, there's just scenes of like kids talking and it's like super sinister. And there's scenes of like little baby Haley Joel Osment like walking down the street and you're like, there's a question here. Like all of the cinematography is telling me there's a question here, but I haven't, like, nobody's asked it yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I think definitely the Sixth Sense is a sort of a surprise mystery because it is a movie with a twist. It doesn't let you know that a twist is coming until the very end. And then kind of simultaneously ruined movies for the next few years, where like every movie absolutely had to have a twist, and also ruined movies for the next few years because people watching movies become desperate to find clues and like things all over them,
mm-hmm.
even if they don't matter, or yeah. even if they are actually ruining
the
experience for themselves.
Yeah.
Like the Sixth Sense is like this, you know, 1999, man, the year that changed movies, right? Some movies, by being good, I think the Sixth Sense is a very good movie,
mm-hmm.
Like changed movies for the worst, both movie culture and movies themselves.
And movie fandom too, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I meant with the culture.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you watched it for the first time, did you know the twist, Rodrigo?
I already knew the twist because somebody had spoiled it for me.
Ah, boo.
But that did not prevent me from enjoying it.
Yeah.
I was, again, going in, God, that came out when I was in high school. When I watched it, I was very entertained the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like all of the actors in that movie are actually very good, including Bruce Willis back when he gave a crap about acting.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like before they just like wheeled him into a project for like a one day shoot and then wheeled him back out.
Mm-hmm.
Like Bruce Willis is acting his bald little heart out in this movie. And it's very good.
Yeah. I can't remember if we watched it the first weekend it came out or the second weekend it came out. We knew there was a surprise that was going to shock everybody, but we didn't know going in. But at the dinner scene where Bruce Willis goes to meet his wife, I was like, oh, this is what's going on. And then I leaned over to the person I was with and I was like, here, I bet you this is what's going on. And that wasn't, I don't even think, halfway through the movie yet.
Sure.
And so then it was just like, well, probably because that person didn't believe me at first. And then when it turned out to be that, that person was very angry. And I was like, I'm just, you know, it's right there on the screen. If you pay attention, you just kind of put the clues together.
Again, this movie that was so impactful, I think, to U.S. culture, that's the impact of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
The impact is, even as you're watching the movie, if you already know there's a mystery, you're working to solve the mystery, and you literally ruined it for someone else because you had to make sure that there was a witness who knew that you had gotten it, right? If you say afterwards that you had it all figured out, no one's going to believe you. You got to tell somebody now.
Yep,
it's
exactly.
Like me being like going to my wife and be like, this is what I think is going on in Loki. And she's like, I'm not watching that. And I'm like, I know, you're the only person I can tell, so that I don't ruin it for anybody. And so that, you know, later on, somebody, like, there will be a mark when I die on my gravestone, you can write, he totally figured out what was going on in Loki before episode 4.
Yeah. So for those of you that are listening to this as it comes out, I realize that the final episode of Loki just aired the day before. We're recording this episode the day before the new episode of Loki arrives. So
yeah, I know
there
what it is, but I'm not.
You
coming.
Go.
I feel, well, let's just not get into it.
We'll do it. We'll do it in a pre-show kind of discussion.
Sure.
I don't care about being spoiled because that can sometimes be part of the fun. Anyway, Matthew, sure. What do you have for your number two?
My number two is an important mystery film because I feel like a lot of times you overlook how important the central character is in a mystery. Because a mystery, a lot of times, you know, is like a romance. There's kind of a formula. And so you want something specific. Hercule Poirot used to say he had these little gray cells in his big egg-shaped head. Or, you know, you have Elementary Watson, which, of course, he never said. Then, of course, you have the incredibly racist number one son with Charlie Chan. But I feel like the quote that really sets it off for me is, not sure I agree with you 100% there on your police work, Lou. Because Fargo, my number two, is a wonderful movie. It's an incredibly cool movie, and I feel like you could they plucked this plot straight out of something with Humphrey Bogart and then said, how can we make this weird, and just did everything weird to it. Your main character is, you know, a pregnant mother from Minnesota. You, the actual murderer, the person doing all of this, is just kind of this goober. I'm not going to tell you who he is, the shoveler. But as you go through this movie, every time you should have a standard kind of, oh, yeah, this is that movie. This is that moment that you get in every film. It's there, but it's different. They put the twist on it. And I feel like I'm not the biggest Coen Brothers guy. There are times where I can take or leave a Coen Brothers movie. You know, Barton Fink didn't really do anything for me. I like some of them. I don't love any of them except for Fargo. Simply because of those quiet moments as they're going along and they're doing the thing, and Marge and her husband are sitting and watching Wheel of Fortune and, you know, eating on TV trays and talking about the murders. And it's just, you know, this really nice kind of down-home weird mystery. And of course, if you've ever been to Minnesota or lived with someone from Minnesota, as I have, you'll know that that accent is legit. It is real. They are not exaggerating a whit. That is how you get, you know, it's scary. And if you want to have fun, watch this movie with Carl, because by the end of the film, Carl will totally be talking like that, eh? And I always go Canadian. I go a little too high with the Minnesota.
Too far north.
Yeah, but if you ever talk to Carl's mother, it's wonderful. She talks like Marge, son of a Gunderson. Which isn't really anything that'll make you enjoy Fargo more, but it certainly won't make you enjoy it less. And I think you should go watch it because it's a good movie and it's my number two.
All right. We have gathered
Fargo,
everyone.
Fargo, the rare example of like a Columbo type mystery, right? Mm-hmm. Where you know who the criminal is. You actually kind of follow both of them.
Yep.
As they're kind of sorting things out and as she's like basically circling around to catch him.
Yep. We know from the beginning what's going on, and the fascination is watching her unravel it.
Yep.
And seeing how very smart she is.
Yeah. So I've gathered everyone here in the room. I've gathered all the suspects. We thought it was going to be Chinatown, but it turned out not to be Chinatown. I know people are looking over in the corner and going, huh, I wonder if it's the Maltese Falcon. No, Maltese Falcon isn't even on this list. I mean, Rear Window is a runner-up movie for me. I mean, that's a very good mystery of who did it and how can we prove that Raymond Chandler actually killed his wife. You might say, oh, well, if it's not the Maltese Falcon, maybe Steven has put the Big Sleep on here. I would say yes, but the Big Sleep in its theatrical release, in my opinion, is not nearly as good as the quote unquote director's cut that was shipping around the U.S. Military in the 40s and 50s. And until they finally put it together in the 1990s and released it, only because in Big Sleep, they cut out all of the threads that said that, oh, the young girl was actually involved in like pornography in a pornography ring. and all these drugs that were being used, but because of the Hays Code, they had to cut all that stuff out. And to me, it doesn't make The Big Sleep as interesting a movie, even though people are all up on the Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall love stuff that's going on. So, it could probably be that, but gosh, I got to ask you, Robert Mitchum, what were you doing on the night that we recorded this show? Were you indeed my number one in Farewell, My Lovely? Farewell, My Lovely is, I didn't discover this until maybe it's less than a decade ago. I know that. But I was in the mood for, okay, let's look at some other, Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett kind of mysteries. But I was looking for something a little bit more hard-edged. I probably discovered it after I discovered the director's cut of The Big Sleep. And Farewell, My Lovely came out in the 1970s. It is a... It's a remake of a version of the film that was done in the 1940s, which I started watching that the other day and turned it off quickly because it was bad, even though a lot of people hail it as a really good movie. But in this is another one of those, go look for the missing girl. Oh, it turns into a murder. Oh, it turns into a double homicide. But because you got Robert Mitchum in it, playing Philip Marlowe, and the fact that in the 70s, the rating system, was totally radicalized and changed. Man, there is big drug use in here. There's nudity in here. There's Sylvester Stallone in here. Farewell, My Lovely is just a really good detective movie that doesn't pull any punches. Chinatown, they get away with a lot. But I think, as I mentioned before, the Polanski angle probably lowers it for me. But the fact that, you can have Robert Mitchum getting shot up with goofballs by this madam of a house, a prostitution house, and has to go through like 20 minutes of the movie in a drug fueled haze. And then finally, figures out what's going on at the end. And then somebody else dies, makes for a really good story. Now, the biggest drawback of Farewell, My Lovely, I think, is the cinematography, because it feels like cheap cinematography and it feels like movie of the week cinematography. I think they could have done a lot more with it, but Farewell, My Lovely is a great film. And I think when it comes to mysteries and following the clues and figuring out who done it and why, this is my number one mystery movie. And when I look at all of the other suspects on my list, I still, nothing can compete with that movie for me. So there you go. Robert Mitchum, you done it in Farewell, My Lovely. Not even the Philip Marlowe movie with James Garner made my list, which is a surprise. But what do you have for your number two, Rodrigo?
My number two. So if you look at my list, it's very obvious that straight up, noir detective fare might not be my jam, right? Mm-hmm. It's just, like Detective Pikachu is in there. You Might Be the Killer. But my number one is a much more straightforward detective tale. It features a private investigator whose partner was recently killed, a femme fatale, and a mystery that continues to get deeper and deeper the more he gets into it. Mm. I'm talking, of course, about the classic Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Yep.
I knew it.
That's a really good one.
It is. Yeah. It's a very, it's like, quote unquote, a straightforward mystery. What complicates everything is that you have to, as you're solving the mystery, they also have to explain to you the rules of Toontown, right?
Right.
And how you can kill a toon, and how you can, how humans can or can't be harmed by them. It's kind of, it's being a detective in a fantasy setting. Although Eddie Valiant, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have too many supernatural abilities the way that the toons do, but he gets help from toons, and that kind of gives him an ability to do things. And by learning the rules of how the toons work, he's often able to get himself out of jams. First off, he's able to track down Roger Rabbit, and second, he's able to get himself out of some sticky situations. Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I think, continues to be one of the best movies ever made. It is not only is it a special effects triumph that holds up to this day, but also it's a fun movie. It's an interesting story. It does have some stuff that I think nowadays, an opening slate say it wasn't okay then and it's not okay now. Right. If I recall, it's pretty minor.
Yeah, it's pretty tame in that sense.
Yeah, all things considered, you know, there's like a bullet that has an Indian headdress, and it probably talks in a terrible, like, quote unquote, Native American accent.
Yeah, he does the Indian whoop.
So you know, there's little things like that. If that makes you uncomfortable, of course, you know, it's not a big deal. But also, the movie has an absolutely wild piano duet between Donald Duck and Daffy Duck.
Yeah, the dueling,
they make fun of each other's speech impediments. Yeah, yeah. Hilarious.
The dueling pianos sequence is one of the best in that film. But the other amazing thing about this is that you got Warner Brothers and Disney to agree to share
to play ball
their characters between.
I've always wondered what sort of absolute horrifying blackmail had to happen there, because this is not a kid's movie. Like, this is a murder mystery. Like, the tunes are not really like the tunes are played at their most, like, I don't know, like picaresque or malevolent, right? They're like little,
these are their 1940s ships. These are their 1940s versions, which are very ribald and very risque.
I'm surprised that, like, what, 85 Disney, and
but you got to remember, 85 Disney was also the time period where they are kind of desperate for wins. You got to remember, Warner Brothers, as far as their Looney Tune collections, are running Saturday morning cartoons and losing audiences because people are like, our cartoons are really too violent for kids. So it's kind of one of those moments where nobody had anything to lose. Disney hadn't released The Little Mermaid yet. Warner Brothers hadn't released Batman yet. So these guys had literally nothing to lose and everything to gain. And if you want to know
And because of that, it gave, what is this, Zemeckis joint?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It gave that creative team the ability to do kind of whatever they wanted with them, which, if you look at something like, here's a Simpsons Star Wars parody in the age of Disney owning both Fox and Disney, it feels saccharine, right?
Yeah.
It feels weak, like very clearly commanded by the overlords. Like, Roger Rabbit is edgy. Roger Rabbit is
subversive,
like pushing what these characters, like, and where these characters exist, and putting them in situations that that really, like you said, really put them back into where they were in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the 80s versions of those characters, right? You look at Bugs Bunny, and it's his current.
No. It was his 40s version of the character.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. And that's the other thing you were saying. I wonder what kind of blackmail. There was still a lot of very tough negotiations on what characters could have big speaking lines and which ones could do what, and making sure that, you know, every studio had equal representation. And that's why in the scene where Eddie Valiant is falling from the skyscraper, they had to make sure that Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse were on the screen at the same time and had the exact same amount of speaking lines in that scene, just to make sure that everyone was like, well, this is my big one and this is your big one, and here we go. So yeah, it's really good. Now, very rarely you're always going to find situations where the movie is better than the book. And sometimes you're like, oh no, the book was better than the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit is a perfect example of the movie was so much better than the book. And if you ever get a chance to read Who Censored Roger Rabbit, it's a totally different book. It's more along the lines of, you know, the toons are part of the newspaper syndicate instead of the movie studios. And, you know, the big whodunit has to do with a missing lamp as opposed to, you know, a missing contract that's going to give Toontown their freedoms.
Right.
Rights.
The will.
Yeah. And it's totally different. It's a totally different mystery. I'm not saying it's a great book. I reread it again recently. It's not a great book, but it's enjoyable, and you can see where they picked little pieces to make Who Framed Roger Rabbit. But the movie's so much better than
a friend of mine recently watched The Happy Time Murders.
Yes, another one that is much better than it has any right to be.
And he said, he's like, this movie was just marketed terribly. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me that it's actually really funny. So I've been meaning to get to it.
Yeah.
But I haven't gotten around.
Yeah,
I
ended up watching it a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago, I guess. And then I was just like, Matthew, this movie is much better than they made it out to be. I thought this was going to be the dumbest of all dumb things. And it's a really solid movie, and it's really funny. So anyway, Matthew, we are not forgetting you. One more thing. Matthew, why don't you share your number one, please?
I find it interesting that two of your movies, one of yours and one of Rodrigo's, have the same plot.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. So my number one is an important film for me because it brings together some very, very talented, classic actors, people that I know, you know, and people that I look at and I go, I have no idea what your name is. But Doc Brown and Lenny and, Professor Frankenfurter and Lily von Stupp all come together in this small house. But what you must remember is that communism is a red herring. 1985, once again, showing my age, Clue. And this is a movie that always fascinated me when I was younger, because when it came out, the marketing was there were three endings. And each ending would play separately in different theaters. And you, as a viewer, were challenged to try and figure out which ending was correct. Who, you know, done it? Who did what? You know, was it Miss Scarlet in the bedroom with a candlestick? Or was it Professor Plum in the refrigerator with a bag of hammers? You don't know unless you've seen it. But if you've only ever seen it on cable or on VHS, you've probably seen a version where all three endings mm-hmm. ran. And that's the thing that I really love, because as this movie unfolds, it really is it's a movie that I like to think of as the revenge of the second Bananas, because everybody in it feels like somebody that you know as the sidekick of someone else from something else. But it also has this weird clockwork plot that kind of crosses around and things happen. And it's wonderfully literate in the way that it puts everything together, but it also borrows from, you know, other movies and mysteries and things of, you know, the 50s and 60s and the 40s and going back all the way to the dawn of movies. First movie was made in 1864 by a guy named Eddie, but that's actually true. And if you have seen Clue, and I believe in France it's called Cluedo, but if you have seen Clue, you know that this is also a group of actors who are known for their ability to improv and ad lib things. And so I watched this movie just wondering how much of the script was actually scripted, because you know they had to have an ending, and how much in the in-betweens actually was written out beforehand, and whether it was just a situation of put Tim Curry and Madeline Kahn in a room and see what happens. But if you never see another film that you would call a mystery, go see Clue, because you really, really will enjoy it. Plus, got Martin Mull, and his mustache is epic.
There you go. All right, ladies and gentlemen, the top five mystery movies. Which ones did we leave out? Which ones did we fail to put on our list? What are the ones that should be?
What clues did we not pick up?
What should be the movies that you would put on a list? Here's what you need to do. You need to head over to the Major Spoilers Discord server. There is a link in the show notes. And then jump down into the top five channel, where I'm sure already people have started sharing their top five mystery movies. I want to follow the clues over to the Discord. Again, just click that link. It's right there in front of you. The clue is in front of you all of the time. Right? And then I want to see how everyone else ranks their favorite mystery movies, as does everyone else. Why? Because everyone loves a list.
This podcast is copyright 2021 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.